This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Welcome. I'm pleased to speak to you today about the National Museum of Australia's recent acquisition of two Staffordshire figurines, both of the Irish nationalist, parliamentarian and convict William Smith O'Brien. And this is a lovely picture of William Smith. William Smith O'Brien's story is very detailed and long, but today I'll be providing an overview of his political life in Ireland, his transportation to Van Diemen's Land, and his triumphant return. William Smith O'Brien was born on the 17th of October, 1803, at Drumalane Castle in County Clare, the second son of Sir Edwin O'Brien and his wife, Charlotte. William's father, Sir Edred, was a member of the old Irish House of Commons, who had opposed the 1800 Act of Union, which saw Great Britain and Ireland form as the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Ireland. Now, this is a lovely contemporary, modern image of Drumalane Castle. It's actually now a luxury hotel. So, and this is where William Smith O'Brien grew up. So it's a lovely, not a bad place to grow up. A Protestant, William was educated at Harrow and Trinity College, Cambridge, speaking several languages, including Latin, Greek, French and German. He graduated in 1828 and was then brought into Parliament by his father and served as the Conservative member for the Borough of Ennis from 1828 to 1831 and then for Limerick from 1835 until 1849. Now, after joining Parliament, he met Mary Ann Wilton in London and, by her, fathered two children. In the autumn of 1832, however, he'd married Lucy Caroline Gabbett of County Limerick. Together they had seven children, five boys and two girls. The family home was known as Kermoyle House. During his time in Parliament, O'Brien was prominent in debates on Irish issues, including the establishment of an Irish poor law, removing tithes, improving education and encouraging immigration. O'Brien was also active in trying to alleviate the misery of the Irish famine of 1845 to 1849 by forwarding suggestions for cultivating wastelands, establishing fisheries, adjusting landlord-tenant relations and providing employment through railway building. Now, during his lifetime, O'Brien was actually imprisoned twice. A true obstructionist, O'Brien was placed under house arrest by the Surgeon at Arms in 1846 for contempt of the House for refusing to serve on non-Irish committees after receiving a summons to serve on the Scottish Railways Committee. O'Brien was placed in prison, an apartment on the ground floor halfway between the entrances to the Commons and Lords Chambers. The cell was about 14 feet by 9 and only 7 feet of headroom. It contained a small deal table, trestle bed, chest of drawers and a few chairs. The worst feature apparently was the unventilated privy. O'Brien considered his jail small and not cheerful. However, O'Brien was placed in high regard and adulation in Ireland because of his defiance. Now, he actually wasn't in prison for very long. It was only until the end of the session of the House, so... And this is actually O'Brien in his prison. And it's from the Pictorial Times, London Pictorial Times. O'Brien was an ardent supporter of Catholic emancipation, and although a political opponent of Daniel O'Connell, the Liberator, he joined O'Connell's Repeal Association in 1843. The Repeal Association strove for the repeal of the 1801 Act of the Union. O'Brien soon became an authority within it, second to only to the Liberator himself. Now, this actual image shows, just in the back corner, the gentleman with the hat is Daniel O'Connell himself visiting William Smith O'Brien in his prison. However, disputes over the repeal soon divided the Irish nationalist leaders. O'Brien at first adopted a conciliary role, but disillusioned by O'Connell, he walked out of the association with other members of the Young Islanders, including John Mitchell, Thomas Mager and other militants in July 1846. The following year, they formed the Irish Confederates, which sought independence of the Irish nation. In May 1848, John Mitchell, one of the young islanders, was arrested for the publication of his newspaper, The United Irishman, which they say was a manual on how to attack British troops. Well, that's what he was convicted of. He was convicted for treason and sentenced to 14 years transportation, first to Bermuda and then to Van Diemen's Land. So from this time forward, O'Brien was the most experienced and respected of the leaders of the Young Islanders. O'Brien sought to build up a network of armed clubs throughout the country, which would force Britain to concede Irish self-government without bloodshed. The Catholic Church opposed the rebellion, and enthusiasm soon evaporated. However, on the 29th of July 1848, O'Brien, along with Meagher, McManus and Patrick O'Donoghue, led a failed uprising against the Royal Irish Constabulary in the Widow McCormick's Cabbage Patch Garden at Ballingarry in County Tipperary. And this is an image of the failed uprising at the Cabbage Patch. O'Brien was arrested at Thurles Railway Station on the 6th of August 1848 and was sent to Dublin. O'Brien, McManus, Meagher and O'Donoghue were all convicted of treason and sentenced to be hanged, drawn and quartered at Clonmel. The sentence was commuted to transportation for life. O'Brien and his principal lieutenants sailed in the Swift to Hobart Town, where they arrived on the 27th of October 1849. Now, on arrival in Hobart, O'Brien refused to give his parole in return for a ticket of leave and was in consequence denied the privileged treatment afforded to other young island leaders. So he was therefore sent to Darlington Penal Station on Maria Island, of which he wrote, "To find a jail in one of the loveliest spots formed by the hand of nature in one of her loneliest solitudes creates a revulsion of feeling which I cannot describe." At Maria Island, O'Brien was allotted a small cottage and placed under the guardianship of one of the overseers, Mr. Miller. And this is his cottage on Maria Island. So he's actually more of a privileged convict. He didn't have to work. He had his own cottage, separate quarters. He could stroll around the gardens accompanied by Mr. Miller. O'Brien spent much of his time observing and exploring all the novelties which surrounded him. Describing in a journal to his wife the 130 convicts and officers who lived on the island, the flora and fauna, and also his small cottage. And this is actually his handwriting and journal that he wrote to his wife from the National Library of Ireland. However, William Smith O'Brien was determined to leave and attempted an escape on Monday the 12th of August 1850. O'Brien details his attempted escape in his journal, and I'll read out his entry. And it really does show what kind of a stubborn, determined man he was, I think. On Monday last, the 12th of August, I made an attempt to escape from this detestable colony. Having learnt that a small vessel, which was in the habit of bringing goods to Maria Island, was about to proceed from Hobart Town to California, and that it was probable that she should touch at Maria Island, I resolved, if possible, to obtain passage in her. Accordingly, I was on the watch, and as my walks were not restricted within any limit, I strolled during several successive days along the seashore in the direction from which she might be expected to arrive. Upon several of these occasions, I was attended only by my keeper, Mr. Miller. But upon the day in question, I was followed by one of the constables, who have latterly been in the habit of watching my proceedings more closely than usual. It seems that some vague information may have been given to Dr. Tennant, the surgeon, who has since the death of Captain Bailey acted as resident magistrate, and to Mr. Lapham, the superintendent, which induced them to believe that this vessel might possibly be brought to Maria Island for the purpose of carrying me away. Between 1 and 2 o'clock, I observed a vessel in the distance bearing towards the point of the shore on which I was walking. You could easily imagine that during this interval my breast was full of emotion. No one, however, would have discovered this emotion from my demeanour. I sat down with calmness to eat my lunch, after which I took up my book and continued to read to my keeper, as had been my usual practice in our rambles. A boat was sent from the vessel towards the point. I continued to read to my keeper until the boat approached within 200 or 300 yards of the shore. She was rowed by 2 men and steered by a third. I then strolled down to the rocks to the edge of the sea, and when the boat was within 50 yards of the shore, I dashed in. The rocks were less shelving than I expected, and I was soon out of my depth, but as I can swim, this was of little importance. I had dove into the water in order to avoid a struggle with the keeper, and I fully expected that I should be pulled up into the boat and carried off without delay. To my greatest surprise, however, I found that no hand was reached to me, and on looking around, I observed that the constable, who had concealed himself until I had plunged in the water, had rushed out of his hiding place and was presenting a gun at the men in the boat. Without any parley or any effort whatsoever to carry off the men in the boat at once, cried out that they surrendered. In the meantime, I was left in the water among the reeds, and being very heavily laden with dress and with articles contained in my pockets, my position became somewhat perilous. At length, I got to the shore by the aid of an oar. All hope of escape was now nearly extinct. I was desirous to use every chance that delay could offer. I therefore told the constable that he might take my life if he pleased, but that he should not compel me to leave that spot until I felt disposed so myself. I then jumped into the boat and refused to leave it. This proceeding, however, was of little avail, as the keeper and the constable, using an axe with the boatman, they cut a hole in the boat with it. The boat was being rendered useless. I now lost all hope of escape and became anxious, for the sake of those on board the vessel, that they should not obtain whatever advantage might arise from delay. I therefore refused to stir and told the constable and my keeper that they must carry me if they wished to compel me to proceed. They accordingly made an attempt to carry me, but soon found that my weight was too great a burden to be carried a distance of 5 miles. The constable then directed the boatman to carry me, and the cowardly wretches absolutely consented to do so and took each limb for the purpose. Not wishing to annoy the men who had already exposed themselves to some risk on my account, I told them that I would not give them the trouble of carrying me, but I would walk leisurely home. I then proceeded at the slowest possible pace. And I think this really does show what a stubborn and determined man he was. I love that. I proceeded at the slowest possible pace. For his failed attempt to escape, O'Brien was transferred to the infamous secondary penal station, Port Arthur, on the 24th of August, 1850. And this is his cottage at Port Arthur, 2 side views of the cottage. As at Maria Island, O'Brien was placed in solitary confinement in a small 2-bedroom cottage next to the barracks. In November 1850, he was persuaded to give his parole and was granted a ticket of leave. O'Brien settled at first at New Norfolk and later Avoca, where he acted as tutor to the children of Dr. Brock, the local doctor. On the 22nd of February 1854, responding to representations from Irish politicians and even the American ambassador, James Buchanan, Lord Palmerston, Home Secretary in the Aberdeen Cabinet, acted and announced a conditional pardon for the 3 remaining young islanders. They were still excluded from the United Kingdom, but they were free to travel elsewhere. Great rejoicings occurred throughout Ireland, and at his parents' estate, Drumoland, huge bonfires were lit for William Smith O'Brien. When the pardons arrived in Van Diemen's Land in May 1854, an enthusiastic reception was organised at the Bush Hotel in New Norfolk, where 30 of O'Brien's friends, led by Captain Michael Fenton and Major Henry Lloyd, dined with him and presented him with an address. On the 6th of July, O'Brien sailed for Melbourne on board the Ladybird. The esteem in which O'Brien was held by many Irish Australians was shown through the large demonstrations held in both Melbourne and Bendigo in his honour. At the final demonstration at the Criterion Hotel on the 22nd of July, he was presented with a large 9-carat gold vase. The vase, which cost 1,000 guineas, was made by immigrant Irish silversmith the Hackett brothers and was financed by Irish Australians, including many miners. The vase was later delivered to Ireland after being shown at the Paris Exhibition of 1855. O'Brien was also presented with an address by the Irish settlers of New South Wales to celebrate his release from detention. And this is his address. After his tour of Victoria, O'Brien sailed for Europe via India, settling with his family in Brussels, where he finished his book, Principles of Government. In May 1856, following the intercession of 140 British parliamentarians, O'Brien was granted a free pardon, which allowed him to return home to Ireland. In 1859, he paid a brief visit to New York. In America, O'Brien was treated not as a failed revolutionary leader living in retirement, but as a major world statesman. William Smith O'Brien, however, died in Bangor, Wales on the 18th of June, 1864. Last year, the National Museum of Australia purchased two Staffordshire figurines of William Smith O'Brien, and they're actually here on display for you today. O'Brien was captured by the Alpha Factory Potters for his criminality and the romance of both his sentence and his relationship with his loving, loyal and long-suffering wife, Lucy, with whom his portrait figure is frequently paired. Now, William Smith O'Brien is the only figurine to have two versions made, both seated and standing. And these are the two that we have in our collection. The seated one is the one that's often paired with a seated Lucy O'Brien. So, the production of Staffordshire ceramic figures reached its peak during the Victorian era, flourishing during the period 1840 to 1880. The relatively inexpensive, simply made porcelain facsimiles of the famous or notorious were produced in response to the current events of the day, making Staffordshire figures excellent examples of popular culture. Staffordshire figurines have been described as ceramic time capsules that not only managed to reflect popular taste but also recreated with great verisimilitude. Yeah. The method of production was cheap and simple, requiring only a three-piece mould. They were sold at weekly fairs and market days throughout England and exported to markets in Australia and North America. Little decoration was employed so as to keep prices down, and gold was rarely used except for titles and incidental decoration, which you can see on the standing O'Brien. There's only very small gold detail on the handcuffs and on his collar. Figures were produced to satisfy the ever-growing demand for likenesses of persons in the news, including members of the royal family, politicians, clerics, war heroes and heroines, theatre performers and famous characters from plays, opera singers, sporting celebrities and notorious criminals. Over this period, more than 500 different subjects were produced as figurines, but only a very small percentage relate to Australia. These are Captain James Cook, English prison reformer Elizabeth Fry, Lady Jane Franklin and Sir John Franklin, William Smith O'Brien, Prince Alfred, then Duke of Edinburgh, bushranger Frank Gardner and the Tichborne claimant Arthur Orton. The National Historical Collection also has two other Staffordshire figurines of Captain James Cook and the Tichborne claimant, which are these here, and also on display for you today. And there's also another possible Staffordshire figurine which also relates to Australia, titled The Smuggler's Quarrel. Now, sorry, I don't have a full image, unfortunately, but this is a nice close-up of the faces. A Staffordshire dealer in England believes that this figurine relates to the story of Margaret Catchpole, a horse thief and jailbreaker who was transported for life to New South Wales in 1801. This identification is a distinct possibility, as the story of Margaret's life, titled The History of Margaret Catchpole, a Suffolk Girl, was published in 1847 at the height of Staffordshire manufacture in England by the Reverend Colbold, son of Margaret's mistress from whom she stole the horse. Although the book is very romanticised, Cobalt recounts Margaret's life and how she had fallen in love with a smuggler, William Lord, and how Lord and another smuggler fought over Margaret, hence the story of the smuggler's quarrel. Margaret's notoriety and Cobalt's story would have certainly inspired Staffordshire potters to use their artistic licence to produce such a piece. although it would warrant a lot more research if this was the case, if this was actually Margaret Catchpole. But it would be nice to think there is another convict Staffordshire out there. The story of William Smith O'Brien, the two Staffordshire figurines, his journal, address, will be going on display with many other wonderful exhibits in the Australian Journeys Gallery, due to open in December this year. I hope that you've enjoyed today's talk. There is a lot more, there's so much more out there about William Smith O'Brien, and it's a very detailed story, so I hope this gives you a little insight into who William Smith was and to our Staffordshire figurines. Thank you.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.